This is Metaphysical Universe, exploring science and spirituality with Dr. Douglas Kelly and Dr. Vicki Hunter.
And a good evening to you for Wednesday, March 6, 2013. I'm Dr. Doug Kelly. Good to have you here. And of course, I'm here with Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Good evening, Doug. Good evening, everyone listening, and particularly those in the chat who've joined us tonight. It's good to see everybody.
Yes. And I'm just running into some lock screen. I'm not sure my chat room's working yet. I may have to reload it. If I have to reload it, that means that everybody may have to refresh. I'll let you know. My computer seems to be a bit slow, but it doesn't prevent me from welcoming everyone. Metaphysical Universe is a weekly service and educational program of the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit, as well as to explore science and spirituality. And in addition to this program, we also have Metaphysics Institute, a metaphysics school offering bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees in metaphysics with various specializations available. And we also have our new sister site, newageclass.com, where folks can take standalone certificate courses and certification courses. So if you'd like more information on those two, metaphysicsinstitute.org and newageclass.com. And before we get into our topic tonight, we're going to do our usual profession of beliefs. The spiritual philosophy of MCHS Church is based upon 9 principles of belief. These principles of belief are, number 1, as sentient and evolving human beings, we not only believe in practicing and living by the principle do no harm, but also in the principle of do right, thus enhancing the vibrational level of humanity. Number 2, we believe in the indomitable power of the human spirit to ultimately triumph in the face of any dilemma. The answers we seek already exist within us. And I just have been informed that, lost me in the chat, I will correct that in just a moment. Number 3, we believe that we alone are responsible for and capable of solving human social problems, and believe the roots of those solutions lie in exploring, understanding, and empowering the human condition. Number 4, we embrace the differences that make all human beings unique, recognizing that we all come from star material and are therefore equal, irrespective of heritage, beliefs, gender, or gender preference. One planet, one race, one ancestry, one destiny. Number 5, rather than a supreme being, we recognize and honor the divine energy that exists in all living things. Number 6, we believe the nature of a human being encompasses both a physical and spiritual aspect, and that human consciousness survives the death of the physical body in a coherent fashion. Thus, death opens a new chapter of life and conducts the individual into a higher state of existence. Number 7, we believe in self-acceptance, self-responsibility, and respect for free will, and that these 3 synergistically create the goal of self-completeness. Number 8, we believe in the value of practical education in metaphysics, metapsychology, and life skills as a means of empowering the human spirit and enhancing the human condition. We maintain an open but grounded mind to potential realities as yet undescribed by science. Number 9, we believe that discovering the true nature of consciousness and human existentialism will ultimately have a positive impact on human evolution and peaceful coexistence. For more information on MCHS Church, as well as these 9 principles of belief, please visit mchschurch.org. Now, let's see if I can correct the chat. I don't know if Vicki, is the chat still working? Or
the chat is working, but you're not in it.
Well, that's okay.
We still have some folks here in the chat room, but
reopen it. So if you don't see any activity in the chat room here, I'm gonna.
We may have to refresh.
You may have to refresh your screen. So let me open it up. Don't know what's going on with this, but I am reopening or going into the chat. So I will say hello once I get back in there. And I'm here.
There you
go.
Are, Doug.
Okay,
there
so it are. Is working good.
Yeah, you're there.
All right. So
well, tonight, tonight we are going to talk about principle number 6, that we are physical and spiritual beings and that consciousness survives death. And of course, we're going to discuss the evidence, and actually you're the better one to, you know, bring forward some of that evidence, Doug. But if anybody has any stories they'd like to share or questions they'd like to ask, please feel free to write them in the chat room.
Right.
We still don't have somebody, you know, call screening just yet, but so we can't take phone calls. But just know we are in the chat room and put your questions forward.
Well, and if you are listening to the live program and you're in the chat room and you want to call in with an experience, you can just type in the chat room that you're calling in, and then I'll know that that's who it is. We've just, in previous years, we've had problems with prank callers saying nasty stuff on there, so I don't like to put anybody on the air when we don't have them screened.
Especially the people that want to save us.
Yeah. Well, and they had some racial stuff that went on. That's back when I was doing Paranexus Universe. So let's talk about the evidence for life after death. And this is obviously a fascinating topic. But what I'd like to do tonight is have a discussion on why I believe that life after death is a reality. And I will tell you that I did not come to this belief or to this point until somewhat recently. In the last 3 years or so, I was kind of on the fence. And I finally had compiled enough evidence for myself to basically believe that that's the way it is. And I'll kind of take you through my arguments for life after death. One of the things that I also want to point out, one of the things we teach at MCHS, or, well, not only at MCHS, but IMHS, or Metaphysics Institute, and the curriculum, the doctoral degree curriculum, is obviously we teach groundedness, but one of the things I teach is that if you're going to believe something, have a compelling basis for it. Have some reasonable evidence, and so that you can draw a logical conclusion. Obviously, with metaphysics, there's so much of it we just can't prove, like the scientific method. You know, we can't reproduce it. We can't prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt. So we're not really talking about that kind of evidence. What we're really talking about is there a rational, reasonable, compelling basis for the conclusion that life goes beyond death? And I think there is, and this is what we're going to talk about. Another thing that I teach is that if you're going to say something, bear in mind that your reputation's at stake. And I know that only too well. When I teach paranormal science, you know, the evidence is only as good as the credibility of the person putting it forth or the researcher. And so what I want to do here is run through some of the different things that have really made my decision for me or support my belief in life after death. There's several of them, too. One of the big ones is something called the survival hypothesis. Many people are familiar with that. It's based on the first law of thermodynamics, that energy cannot be created or destroyed, can only be transformed. And so therefore, all the energy in the universe is balanced. It's neither created nor destroyed. It just changes from one form to another. We can see that every day. For example, you put gas in your tank and it's transformed into motion, forward motion or motion energy. You turn on the light switch and electricity is now transformed into light energy. So we see that all the time. And so the survival hypothesis is an interesting one because, well, what about our life force that is us? You know, when we die, where does it go? Now, some people could say, well, it could just be dispersed out in the universe. Well, it could be. So what's the case for coherent transference? In other words, our energy may go on, but does it remain us? Do we survive? Does our consciousness survive in a coherent fashion that is still us? And I think it does. And some of the other evidence that we'll talk about would seem to support that. So the first point for evidence of life after death is the survival hypothesis. Energy can neither be created or destroyed, it can only be transformed. Another point, and it's a big one too, is that of near-death experiences, or NDEs. Some years ago, we had the honor of interviewing Dr. Raymond Moody, who is the author of the book Life After Life that he published back in 1975, and he coined that phrase, near-death experiences, and it's a great book. I highly recommend you read it. You could probably find it at the bookstore. It's still in print. He also, just a couple years ago, well, about 2 or 3 years ago now, published a new book called Glimpses of Eternity. And we'll talk about that in a bit, but that's on shared death experiences, a little bit different. We'll talk about that in a moment. We'll focus on near-death experiences. And just to give you a kind of a nutshell, if you're not terribly familiar with them, a near-death experience is when somebody dies and then they're resuscitated after the fact. And during that period of death or clinical death, they often see a tunnel or a pathway leading to somewhere. They often go along it, and they are often, there will be a life review. It's like in a flash. They see all the things they've done, people they've hurt, people they've pleased, you know, people that brought joy to. There's this light that many people will identify as God or Jesus or Buddha or whoever their religious persuasion is. Sometimes they'll be dead, often they'll be dead relatives, and they will go down this tunnel or down this pathway only to be told they cannot continue past a point. They have to go back. There's also deeply, how do I word it, profound feelings of well-being, and this is where I need to be. I don't want to go back. This feels so good. It's so great. Those kinds of things. And most people, if not all, have a, it changes their life from where they were. I mean, they have a whole new approach to life. Now, I might also add as one more point that most of these near-death experiences are positive. Some people report the negatives. There's always somebody out there who talks about going to hell, which is, you know, honestly just a product of belief. But most of them are very positive experiences. Now, Vicki, I know you wanted to talk about your own experience. So,
you know,
go ahead.
I have examples, too, just by everything you're talking about, Duggan. But first of all, I was 5 years old when I drowned, and I have clear, distinct memory of leaving my body, being in that, of course, my child mind translated it to clouds, you know, that white energy, that white tunnel. But I distinctly remember a connection with this profound energy and what I believe are other energies or entities. But I came back, you know, fairly quickly, having been revived, and that's a profound memory that just sticks with me. I have zero fear of death. I always say dead is easy. It's the getting dead that can be trouble. <You know? laughs> So, you know, I mean, we hope it's, you know, an easy transition. Oddly enough, I don't recall any pain in the drowning process, but I do having come back. That was painful. And so that actually affected me very early in my life. Now, you know, some people have asked me, have I always been particularly intuitive or empathic, psychic, you know, being able to see the future? You know, I don't know if that's necessarily just the way I came in, if there was an impact having drowned at that age and having a near-death experience, or if it was something I grew into, because I believe that all children have, like, imaginary friends, whether they have a conscious memory of it or not. But, it, you know, it's hard to know how much that experience can impact, you know, your energy or your psyche here. So, you know, I know I've talked to a lot of people who have had near-death experiences, and you're right. There is a profound shift of, you know, the view of reality. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, mine was so young. You know, I'm not sure I would have had quite the similar. I have a more youthful willingness to it having been age 5. I believe that. I think that if you're, you know, 25 and have a near-death experience versus being age 5, I do believe there's a difference, and it's the child mind. You know, you said it a moment ago, Doug, about, you know, people's realities. If you have a vision, you know, you're going to see that vision according to your beliefs or however you're framed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people say they see Christ, some people say they see Buddha. What I know is that a Christian won't see Buddha, you know, and a Muslim won't see Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's however, and this is what I mean by the older we get, the more our brains are hardwired.
Mm-hmm.
So we take on a belief, and that is what we perceive. So I think that I like to believe that I had a bit of an edge having been so young to have had a near-death experience. So, you know, that kind of is what I wanted
well,
to
another-
say.
Another aspect of near-death experiences is many, many people report a serious increase or enhancement in psychic sensitivity after these events. It's interesting.
There's a saying in Indian country, you know, with the Native Americans, that we are people, and an elder coined it for me years ago, we're people who walk with a thin veil between the worlds. So maybe that helps to give a visual as to perhaps why people who have had, you know, near-death experiences would become, you know, a little more intuitive or sensitive or psychic.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think it would manifest in many different ways according to the individual. That's not to say, you know, if you died and you come back, you're going to be a profound psychic guru. It just means that it will impact your life through your perception, but a higher sensitivity. I truly believe that.
All right, so let's talk about the evidence. How do near-death experiences contribute to the evidence for life after death? Well, there's a couple of ways. One, the people who study this, the researchers, have logged all kinds of these stories from all around the world, and the stories are remarkably similar, you know, in what happens during these near-death experiences. There have even been cases where the NDE-er, the person who died, will rise above in the room. They'll be, of course, this is common. They're watching themselves being worked on or resuscitated. And then there's been a few cases where the people have actually gone up, you know, a little bit higher. Some have identified objects on the roof or above that they could not have known about otherwise. And so that's compelling. And all the fact that the stories are so remarkably similar, regardless of background, pretty much very, very common traits that are experienced among these people. Now, one of the objections or critiques or criticisms of this is that, you know, science and a lot of medical doctors will explain this as oxygen deprivation to the brain. It sounds good on paper, but it's also interesting to note that there's quite a number in the medical profession who believe in this, who you know, talk to patients who have reported things back to them. And this is where we kind of now segue into something called shared death experiences, SDEs. And again, Dr. Eamon Moody wrote the book Glimpses of Eternity. It's published in 2010. And I highly recommend you go out and pick up Life After Life and Glimpses of Eternity. They're great books. They're fascinating. It's good stuff, good reading. And you can also go to paranexus.org. and look in the radio archives and just look for Raymond Moody. You'll find an interview that we did. I think we did a couple of them. He's just a great, great guy and just very knowledgeable about this stuff. But shared death experiences, what's that? How does that differ from near-death experiences? Well, shared death experiences, pretty much the same stuff, except that the experience is not had by the person dying. Well, they're part of it. It's the people around them, the loved ones who are in the room there when the person dies. They also experience this life review. They see other entities, dead loved ones. They see the white light, the tunnel oftentimes. They share in this near-death experience. Of course, it's not a near-death with these people because these people actually do die. But it's the loved ones who are around them. And there have been quite a number of medical professionals, doctors, nurses, who have also inadvertently kind of been swept into this. They report that the room changes, almost like, the water vapor on a hot summer highway. You know, the room changes, and they see these different things. And it's just fascinating. Dr. Raymond Moody even experienced it himself, which led to his book. And so you can't explain that with...
There's a time distortion, too.
There is. You can't explain that by oxygen deprivation to the brain. So what's going on? Something is. There have been way too many of these reported. So how do we explain it otherwise?
Well, what I know is more profound than my own near-death experience was sharing in my brother's transition. That was the single most profound, perhaps because I'm in, this reality and this consciousness, not having the experience myself, and of course it's somebody you love very dearly, right? So, there's that love factor. But more than just saying a goodbye or bon voyage kind of thing, there was this incredible, the only way I can describe it is like a light translucent cloud or smoke that rose from his body, from his chest.
That's reported too by a lot of these SDE experiences.
And the most overwhelming, Doug, almost, it's beyond a description, experience of love. And a time distortion, a time warp. There were two medical professionals at the end of the room at the doorway who were present at that moment. And I know they felt the same or something similar, but there I was. I had my hand on my brother. And so I had this physical connection. And I don't know if that had anything to do also with, the how profound it was. But to be with him in the, like a liftoff, if you will, his body is here, but he's not. And that there is this experience that transcends this life. It was so reassuring to me. It was the greatest gift that I could ever have experienced in my life. And I've had a lot of great experiences, but nothing as impactful to my right down to the root of my core, if you will, because it gave me a different, a renewed perspective. I was pretty well intact with my philosophies, having been an NDE, having pursued metaphysics all my life, having, talked to dead people and spirits all the time. But this one moment opened up a whole new view. So I'm not sure how Dr. Moody describes that, because I have not read his second book. I have read Life After Life back in the 70s, in fact. But this, it was pivotal. It's very difficult to describe the shared death experience, but that's as best as I can do it.
Yeah, and that's good. So we have the survival hypothesis, we have near-death experiences, we have shared death experiences, and we know that something's going on. So, how else do we explain it? Obviously, something's going on here. I mean, people are living beyond death. I don't know how else to explain it. I have not had a shared death experience, nor have I had a near-death experience at this date. But there's still some other evidence. And so we're kind of piecing the evidence together here. Some of the evidence that I have participated in is the paranormal research kind of evidence. Now, most of these so-called paranormal events are not. And honestly, probably 95% of them can be explained with, natural occurrences, hoaxes, not so many, but that's one part of it. Another one is just misidentification. And then there's client psychology, which plays a big role in something I call the I'm special syndrome, where folks with low self-esteem unconsciously will create an event or identify a natural event as something paranormal. So most of these cases can be explained one way or another. But there's this small percentage of these cases that you can't so easily explain. And I've been on some investigations where we had some of these types of things. And one of the things that we used to do a lot, that I'd like to do more of, is table tipping seances. And this is something that you just have to experience to believe. It's real easy to sit back and watch a video and say, oh, well, you know, they're just moving that table. But I have participated in many of them, and they're just fascinating. That table seems to move of its own volition. Now, I don't know whether it's collective consciousness of the people at the table moving it. I don't know whether the energy's coming from the group at the table and the spirits are moving it, kind of manipulating that one way or another. But regardless, you'd have to practice together for a long time to be able to move that table in concert like it's done. It's just fascinating. But what's really interesting is the information that comes from that kind of an experience. Now, we can also say, well, you know, it's coming from the psychic ability of the facilitator. Maybe they're dialed into the Akashic record, global consciousness, universal consciousness, and they're sort of getting this information from there. But that's not always so easy to say. There's information that comes that people shouldn't know. I'll give you a couple of experiences. Let's see. One of them we were doing in Clewiston, Florida here a few years back. We were actually at a conference, a paranormal conference. And so there was about, I don't know, six or so of us at the table. And one of the participants at the table had never done a table tipping and wasn't necessarily psychic, didn't consider herself to be psychic or anything. So we're all doing the table tipping, and she kind of starts to act a bit strange, almost like she's going into a bit of a trance. And she's getting some information. I'm just going to use the name Richard. I don't think it was exactly Richard, but there was somebody coming through, and that was the name that came up. And it meant something to her, and she was like going into this trance, and she's kind of saying, give me a piece of paper. And so we grabbed a piece of paper and a pen and put it in her hand, and she's basically got her eyes closed, and she starts automatic writing right on the spot, and she writes out the name. I guess that's where we got the name, Richard, and then the last name, and it's just, you know, it looks like almost doodling, and then the characters start to come. So where's that coming from? You know, that's an interesting experience. There's so many the psychics too, where that information comes in. And now we could say it comes from the Akashic record, which is universal consciessness. But what about ones that come through? Go ahead.
We interviewed, and I'm sorry, his name totally escapes me right now. But last year we interviewed the fellow in England who had a spirit on tape.
Right. Have to go back in the archives. Great guy.
Yeah, and that's one of the first actual audios, you know, like recorded audios, that the psychic who was there at the time was overwhelmed to hear it played back, because she said that's the first time she'd ever had a validation of what she heard in her head. And I was really moved by that, actually, because that's what happens to me, too. You know, it's like, I know what's going on in my head, but to hear it through an audio tape would be extraordinary.
Well, that brings us to EVPs, right? Electronic voice phenomena. In my opinion, in terms of paranormal research, that's one of the most compelling types of evidence we have. EVPs are not that hard to get. You go through the protocols, you make sure that you're not getting any spillover from people. But I've gotten a number of EVPs that I can't explain. You know, that where does that come from? I mean, is it possible that it's psychokinetic on the part of somebody who's psychically sensitive in the group, where somehow their consciousness you know, records this on a tape. Well, that's possible. Is it likely? Probably not. But it could happen, I guess. Don't have any proof for that. But we're still getting these voices. We're getting these recordings. And we've had Dr. Ingrid Irwin on a couple of times in the past, and she's had some remarkable ones. And I've gotten them. So, you know, where does that come from? You know, it's coming from something. And of course, with our when we do the investigations, where there's always some psychic person with us, because in my opinion, that's just required. So they're getting information, which is later validated. Talk about escaping names. I know his name as well as I know my own. Of course, I can't think of my own name right now, but.
Here's the thing that there are many dimensions of time space, and even if we take this into a scientific understanding, we are now opening up into quantum mechanics profoundly, and we're now realizing that there are many universes occurring simultaneously. I mean, it's almost verifiable through science. So if we have many energy levels or many dimensions of time space or many worlds within worlds, if we think about that, we are sharing a space right now with other perhaps life forms, but there could be many. Maybe maybe this is level 3 on 3 million levels that we have yet to be conscious of.
Say it ain't so.
Well, it's entirely true. You know, I mean, we don't know. So when I've had experiences too where I don't tape readings for anybody anymore, because very often there was too many complaints, Doug, and people thought then that I guaranteed the readings and we had to do it all over again if it didn't work. And very often electronics don't work around me. It's just a phenomenon. But when they would work, they would get garbly. They would get, all staticky. Occasionally, there were cases, well, one in particular that comes to mind, a woman said that there was this very British kind of guy in the background, you see, and it was a brand new tape opened from the cellophane wrapper, put into the machine. So this was not a pre-used tape, but she had said to me when she played it back, she could hardly hear my voice, but she could hear this other fellow talking. Now, I never got enough into all the verifiable data. You know, I had a busy life doing other stuff, but now I'd like to do that because who better, I guess, mm-hmm. when there's all this stuff going around. Mm-hmm. But it was just for me, it was just troublesome, actually, because I didn't want to guarantee tapes for people when they wanted to play back their readings. So I would say, take notes, please. You know, bring your own machine, absolutely, you know, record away, but I can't do it for you because I just can't guarantee it. But there's been many times when there have been, you know, there's been something on an audio. So a world within a world within a world makes sense to me. It's just we can't see it, but it is occurring simultaneous to our reality.
Yep, and that could very well be, you know. There's a lot of things. There's another thing, too, that we could throw into this mix of evidence, and that's deathbed visions. And those are simply incidents where a person who is dying, you know, in the hospital usually, doesn't have to be, but they're dying. They're often unconscious and have been unconscious for some length of time, and they're just, you know, counting the hours and the days left. And then all of a sudden they wake up into full consciousness and they start talking to someone over in the corner. Often it's their mother, but not always. And they're having there's such a positive experience for them. And it's all about the dead loved one welcoming them or assisting them over to the other side. And people who have experienced these types of deathbed visions on the part of a loved one, a dying loved one, are just moved by them. And they're fascinating. And again, we get the commonality. We get that same thing that happens a lot. It doesn't happen every time, but it happens a lot. And somebody who's been unconscious for a long time, and then all of a sudden they wake up, they're fully lucid, and then they have this deathbed vision, and then they're back to unconscious again, and they usually, you know, pass away fairly quickly afterward.
Sorry, Doug, don't they say that that's the least verifiable, though? Because medical professionals would say that that is some kind of oxygen deprivation or some kind of delusion, or, you know, the body is making a transition.
Could be. You know, and that's the interesting thing. With all of these different things that we've been talking about here, if you take them alone, well, there's always something you could say to criticize them or to debunk them, if you know, to use a common term. But when you take all these different things together, something's going on. What is it? Well, if we use Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is likely the correct one, then we have to conclude that there must be life after death. Plus, if you just look at it from a reasonable point of view, you know, all of the incredible power and ability of the human mind, of the human being, the fact that us being here is literally a miracle. It, you know, everything had to happen just right for us to even be here. And a lot of folks lose appreciation. They don't appreciate that fact. A lot of stuff. Think about ancestors back during the Dark Ages or whenever. If one of them had been killed, you wouldn't be here. So everything had to happen just so. So here we are, and we only live 70, 80 years maybe, if that. You know, all this creativity, this ability, you know, we spend all this time learning and growing and we're doing things, and then we're just going to die and that's it? Really? You know, whose brainchild was that? And that doesn't make any sense, you know. And when we look at consciousness and the power of consciousness and the fact that quantum mechanics, quantum physics is really discovering things that really kind of dovetail with consciousness, that, you know, how do we formulate these subjective experiences? They're called qualia. You know, if we both go on a roller coaster ride, we're going to both come away with different individual subjective experiences of that event. That's why you can ask 10 people who witnessed an accident what happened, and they all have their own version, because it's unique to us. And so if our consciousness is that powerful and we're literally creating our reality, not magically, but we are in essence creating that reality that we're in, then to say that that's it makes no sense. And if we look at the universe, there's a lot of sense. There's a lot of order to it. You know, there's reasons for things.
Well, I know that everything I've experienced is going into my report, and I'm taking it with me. And whoever's out there, everybody's going to know. That's what I say. You know, and maybe we'll even pick a different planet next time. So there.
And maybe we have. You know.
And maybe we have. See, that's another interesting notion that we've only just begun to explore. In the event, life on other planets, who's to say that we have only lived on this one? Mm-hmm. In the event that if there is life after death, then it's quite possible in a particular time, space, linear kind of thinking that reincarnation is a possibility, which I believe it is, from one perception, then maybe we don't always pick Earth. Now, that's another notion that we could explore.
Well, reincarnation is a thing in itself, and we've talked about that. And is it a possibility? Sure, it's a possibility. It just doesn't have as much compelling evidence as all the other things that we've had. Now, if you've lived it or you have memories of past lives, then it's real to you. And I'm not talking to just you, Vicky. I'm talking to anybody who may have that. I personally have no memories of any past lives. Maybe I haven't had any past lives, but that wouldn't make any sense either. But the point is that when we look at the evidence for life after death, there's just an awful lot of stuff. Here's another quick story, and there's many examples like this. A colleague of mine, he told me about his experience when he was a child, and he is psychically sensitive. He was about 5 years old, and he was staying with his grandmother, and they had neighbors, and the neighbors, the man had passed away, not to just, you know, prior to this event. And the widow was there, and they were, she was having coffee or tea or something with this, with my friend's grandmother. Well, my friend was out in the yard playing, and his grandma came in and told him to come in and eat. And she asked, who were you talking to? Because he was talking to this man, this elderly man. And he said it was, you know, this widow's husband. And she said, well, he's passed away. Well, he has a message for her. And so the message was to go look at a certain spot in a drawer, under the drawer, taped below the drawer, and there was some papers that this deceased man wanted his wife to have, some important papers and some cash, a couple thousand dollars worth of cash. And, you know, here we have this five-year-old kid. How could he have known that? You know, where did that come from? And so, and that was validated. But there are many experiences like that. It's just fascinating. So when we put all of it together, is death really the end? Well, if you're a materialist, then yeah. But if you're a dualist, then no. You know, and it just doesn't make sense. So we've got plenty of evidence. You know, so now, what does that do for our life now? Well, if we move on to a different chapter, it certainly negates futility, because even though we're not where we might want to be in this life, death is not the end. So let's keep working to make our lives better, to do right, to do no harm, to lighten the load, to be part of the solution rather than the problem, because we continue on. Those are nice thoughts.
No matter what was before or after us, Doug, this moment is all there is.
That's true.
So we're living in this moment, in this be here now. And no matter what's, and what I mean by afterwards, I mean even tomorrow or after this lifetime. It's the be here now, the quality of this moment.
Yeah. So at least it gives us hope. You know, and hope is obviously a beautiful thing. All that we have is that hope. And we don't want to negate it. We don't want to put it down. We don't want to dismiss it. And we don't want to get lost in this moment of now and being focused on things that really don't matter. So make the most of your life. Make, you know, educate yourself. Grow. Evolve. Try to be better tomorrow than you were yesterday. You know, be the best you can be. That's
live in your value.
Yeah. Learn the lessons of your journey, of your path. We all have that. So, good.
Well, it's another great show, Doug. I love these topics, and really glad that people stopped by and joined in. And thank you very much. I hope everybody comes back again next week. Of course, we'll be addressing principle number 7.
Yep. So we'll have a topic on that. And we do appreciate everybody taking your time and joining us. We know life is busy, and we appreciate the time that you're spending, whether you're listening live or to the archive. And again, if you like what you're hearing, tell others about it. If you'd like more information about MCHS, then visit mchschurch.org. If you'd like to get your degree in metaphysics, visit metaphysicsinstitute.org. Or if you'd like to take a class, newageclass.com will get you there as well. All right, that's all I got for this week. So, hope everybody has an awesome week. And until next week, please listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Have a great week. Good night.
Good night, everyone.